Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Geneva II talks that began in Montreux, Switzerland, amid acrimony and testy exchanges between Syria's foreign minister and the head of the UN. A specialist on Syria and U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, Aram Nagizian, a senior fellow and chair in strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies, joins us to discuss the bitter negotiations underway between the warring parties and the need for the outside parties in this proxy war, Iran and Saudi Arabia, to reach some sort of agreement or modus vivendi. Then we'll look into the report just released by Oxfam, Working for the Few, that finds just 85 people on this planet are as wealthy as half of the world's population, the poorest 3.5 billion. Rodrigue Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics and International Finance at the University of Montreal and author of The New American Empire and The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles, joins us to discuss the impact this report will have on the 2014 World Economic Forum underway in Davos, which last Thursday issued an assessment that income disparity was one of the 10 global risks of highest concern in 2014. Then finally, we will speak with veteran Senate and House staffer Mike Lofgren, the author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We will discuss his article at Truthout, Gates Agonistes, that looks into the political agenda behind the release of Robert Gates' new book, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense at War, which Mike Lofgren calls a political psyop disguised as a candid tell-all memoir. And joining us now is Aram Nagizian, who's a senior fellow and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagizian has authored or co-authored a number of reports for CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagizian.
Thank you for having me.
And the Geneva II talks have begun in Montreux, Switzerland, between the Assad regime and the coalition of rebels. Already there's been testy exchanges and a lot of acrimony, which is not surprising, of course. But it does seem that the Syrian foreign minister, who was supposed to speak for 7 minutes, went on for quite a long time, which irritated Ban Ki-moon, who kept interjecting. And it doesn't sound like it's going well. Is that something you would agree with?
Well, look, we all knew that this would be one of a series of potential points throughout this crisis where you'd have at least some cosmetic progress. And even then, I use the term cosmetic progress very loosely. You have a conflict where you still have a very real division within the opposition. You have all the effects of militancy and radicalization. You have a regime that has both dug in its heels and taken advantage of these weaknesses within the armed opposition, but also is taking advantage of the bully pulpit of going to Geneva, to Montreux, and a singular opportunity not only to foil the agenda of regional opponents in the Gulf, like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other states, and certainly the United States in the West, but also for individuals like the foreign minister to prove their own bona fides at home. There is a domestic audience for Foreign Minister Moallem's verbose speech, not just one that is international. The real question that analysts will have to answer at some point is, beyond the public boasting and rhetoric, when you actually do have a moment where there will be a discussion about what happens next between the opposition groups that are there and regime representatives, not just the likes of Moallem, but also his deputy, Faisal Naqdad, who in many ways is the shadow foreign minister to begin with, who represents the Alawite core of the regime. Then the question is, how far will they go? And frankly, most of us who are following this are not expecting much. We're expecting a series of public statements that may or may not have some impact in terms of the humanitarian crisis, which right now is probably the most pressing issue in Syria. But no illusions that this is the first of multiple attempts to breathe some kind of life into a discussion about some sort of a transition at a time when neither the Assad regime nor its opponents are realistically contemplating any notion of defeat.
Well, apparently these talks are supposed to go on for 2 days before they move to Geneva for what the French foreign minister says is the real conference. So do you think they'll get through these 2 days of acrimony?
Look, realistically, anything and everything that can go wrong has gone wrong in the past in other countries with similar crises and efforts to de-escalate a divisive civil war. That doesn't mean that any of us who are looking at this can predict this reliably. In the best case, they make it to Geneva. You have the closed-door discussions. Anything that is leaked will be done so with an attempt to actually get the information out. Whether that's good or bad will depend on how the discussions go. Our own expectations are that basically there will be very limited progress in this round of talks. You've already had a false start, both in terms of how the Iranians were invited, but also more critically in how that invitation was reversed. This is a conflict that does have a domestic component. You have forces that are aligned on either side. But like other cases of geopolitics by proxy, one cannot deny the overwhelming influence and role played by countries that are supporting competing factions. So when you have, on the one hand, countries like Saudi Arabia present, that sends a signal of some degree of seriousness. But the fact that you have other sponsors, like the Iranians, not there, on the one hand, is a very public rebuttal. And on the other, could also present the Iranians with just more reasons to continue on the course that they've set for themselves, which is one whereby they continue to support Assad, continue to push for him to have autonomy and command and control in areas he does have oversight in, and craft some kind of a strategic victory, or at least a non-defeat for Iran, in the face of recurring efforts to end the crisis. So our expectations are tempered by all of these patterns, the fact that local forces and their allies are not really in the mindset to negotiate for peace, as opposed to negotiate for some kind of surrender, which, again, none of the competing factions are seriously contemplating.
Well, my understanding, Aram Nagizian, is that the American objection to Iran being in the talks was that Iran refused to sign on to Geneva 1, which laid the groundwork, presumably, for Geneva 2, inasmuch as Iran has rejected any notion of regime change. And my understanding is that the rebels, when refused, they were going to walk. So that Ban Ki-moon had to choose between having the Iranians there or the rebels there, and obviously he needs the rebels more than the Iranians. Is that how it worked out?
Well, frankly, I think it's a little early to cast doubt or blame on any of this. To say that the presence of the opposition is essential is accurate. They have to be at the negotiating table just as much as the regime does. But I would be very careful about any kind of allusion that countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran are any less critical. This is a two-level contest. You have local forces that need to sign the peace, or need to continue to press in a form of competition in Syria that has essentially become a blood sport. But at the same time, you have these countries that also need to be a vibrant component of de-escalation. If you exclude them, if they're not part of the discussion, then you're not going to have any real impact. And we've seen this in other theaters, other attempts in other conflicts, like in the Lebanese Civil War, when you've had past agreements like the one in the 1983 cycle, which eschewed or disregarded the strategic imperatives of countries like Iran and Syria at the time, ended up in failure. And we forget all the other attempts to end that conflict right up until 1989, 1990, when you had the Taif agreement. That's not to say that we can dismiss this talk altogether. It is to say that when you do exclude countries like Iran, like Saudi Arabia, and do it in a way that is frankly embarrassing for the UN and for the entire process. Best case scenario, you've just set this back for the next round of negotiations with all the costs in human lives and the humanitarian crisis that come with that. But also, I think realistically, no one has set the bar so high that if this particular round of talks fails, you're not going to have something else in the future that may or may not have a better chance of success.
So just prior to these talks opening, three very prominent human rights and war crimes prosecutors released a report that involved 55,000 photographs taken by a Syrian military police photographer whose job it was to photograph the bodies of those people who had been murdered in the prison system, 11,000 all told. One, to show the Assad regime that their orders had been executed, and two, to show photographs to the next of kin rather than the tortured body. This apparently is, according to human rights specialists that I've spoken to, this is a very credible report, and it would seem already with the Secretary of State John Kerry saying, the right to lead a country does not come from torture. The only thing standing in the way is the stubborn clinging to power of one man. So it would seem that highly coincidental that this report came out on the eve of Geneva II. Do you think that forecloses the possibility of Assad clinging to power, and that he may, you know, obviously that's been a precondition of his, that we're not going to negotiate my exit, and the rebels are saying we're not going to, you know, your exit is also required. So there's an impasse there. What impact do you think this torture report has had?
Look, whether it's an authoritarian regime, and there are many, both friends and opponents of the U.S. and Western states, or the case of Syria, there's nothing civil about any of this. Authoritarianism isn't civil, and civil wars aren't civil. You have an environment of violence. You have an attempt to shape strategic victory, in many cases with all of the crimes that come with it. And Syria will neither be the first nor the last conflict where you have this sort of activity, or a country where you can have any real sense of a stable transition with transitional justice assured for all. The concept of transitional justice is still a fairly new one. It's been difficult to implement under the best of circumstances, and we're already seeing a great deal of negative reaction in places like Africa, where the issue of, you know, who has the legitimacy to conduct this and how is being aggressively contested by exactly the kinds of regimes that, frankly, would conduct this sort of exercise. But I think we're, again, diverting from the bigger issue here. The bigger issue is, with all of the costs of a civil war, including unacceptable levels of violence and torture on both sides, especially on the part of the Assad regime, no doubt, you have the reality that you have a strategic contest here. You have an Assad regime, for all of the torture and accusations and acrimony rightly deserved, is one small part of a much bigger puzzle in terms of what the Middle East will look like, what it will look like in terms of instability, what it looked like in terms of strategic competition, what it looked like in terms of the ascendancy or otherwise of Islamist factions that are or aren't affiliated with al-Qaeda and its partners. All of these issues revolve around Syria. All of the facts tied to socioeconomic and demographic pressures are there too, including the kinds of ethnic cleansing that we've seen in other conflicts like Bosnia, like Lebanon, where you've had internal displacement, where you've had the homogenization of urban and rural centers. We are seeing this in Syria. It's happening apace, and it'll continue regardless of whether or not there is a question of some kind of eventual transitional justice. And on the issue of whether Assad does or doesn't cling to power, we need to be realistic about what kind of a end state can emerge, at least in terms of the strategic partners on either side of the conflict. At some point, countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran are going to have to compromise on their maximalist visions for Syria. For the Saudis, that is one where you have some form of Sunni majority rule and influence for the Gulf in a place like Syria. Whereas for the Iranians, that is a dramatic reversal of fortune and the restoration of Assad's control over the entire country. And both countries' visions, both the Saudi interpretation and the Iranian one, will have to be curbed. And at some point, when you do have some kind of a final moment and a gradual shift to a post-civil war environment, and granted one which will likely be unstable and in conflict with itself for a decade, if not more, you're going to have some kind of an a posteriori arrangement vis-a-vis Assad, if he is still in power when peace does eventually come. And the Iranians have probably no illusions about this. They can certainly kid themselves now, given that we're still in many ways at the early stages of a much longer conflict. But in the end, they will have to make a compromise. It might be Assad. It might be something else. But so will their strategic opponents.
Well, Aram Nagizian, if indeed, and obviously this is the case, that this is in many ways, a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and as you pointed out, until they're at the table and until they're fully engaged and somehow can compromise from the maximalist positions, we are not likely to make much progress. But you basically have two competing theocracies that are pretty distasteful in many ways. And the real question to me would be, which one is likely to reform? Do you think reform is possible in Saudi Arabia, or is it more possible in Iran?
Look, the irony of these two countries, and with very different political systems to boot, is that in their own ways, they both have to strive to some kind of reform. They have real pressures in terms of a youth bulge and unemployment. The Iranians have all the pressures tied to sanctions. The Saudis have all the pressures tied to a world where they need to be more productive, more able to bring junior elements into the labor market, and so on. You basically have an environment where these countries can make some progress, where they can do some things to alleviate these pressures. And they can also try to deal with the fact that they are, in conventional terms, hegemonic opponents. And for all the talk of their theocratic values and how those have polluted the strategic contest, namely how it has inflamed Sunni-Shiite divisions, at the end of the day, these are countries behaving in many ways like any other country, competing for a limited amount of influence in the geographic space they occupy. They are mobilizing the Sunni-Shiite divide. They are using it for their own strategic ends. But at the same time, those dividing lines will shift and will increase or decrease based on that competition. So tomorrow, if you have some kind of move towards de-escalation, you will have a de-escalation of Sunni-Shiite tension. If you also have all of these patterns evolve in a way that is conducive, you can have some kind of prospect for reform, but realistically, we're talking a much longer time frame.
But in terms of the opening with Iran from the P5 plus one, and the fact that the U.S. and Iran have been talking recently, and you know there in Washington there's been a lot of pushback. There's 59 U.S. senators signed on to essentially scuttle the deal before it even gets it's underway, but barely underway. What explains that, and is there a possibility of a kind of Nixon and China moment here? Could there be a strategic realignment with Iran, or getting closer to the Iranians and distancing the U.S. from Saudi Arabia?
One of the ironies of a recent trip I did to the Gulf and to Lebanon is that you have local forces in these countries interpreting U.S. intentions and actions one way, and in a way that, frankly, is divorced from how the U.S. probably is conducting its affairs in dealing with countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran. If you were to go to Lebanon today and ask, what do you think of U.S. policy in the Levant? The overwhelming view is that somehow the U.S. and Iran have found the means to bury the hatchet and in some ways work together at least on counterterrorism and intelligence sharing. Of course, that is far removed from the reality. The U.S. is not involved in active counterterrorism operations that involve dealing with the Iranians in what would be described as a partnership or anything like that. The reality here is that the U.S. and some of its allies in the EU are trying to do two things at once, trying to maintain the architecture of security in the Gulf, reassure countries like the UAE, like Qatar, and like Saudi Arabia, while also moving very aggressively to de-escalate or at least shift the terms of discussion in dealing with Iran. And the idea there is that basically a country like the U.S. should do absolutely everything it can to avoid the march to war, which frankly would be disastrous for Iran first and foremost, not for the United States. And also by doing so, and by pushing this aggressively, putting the onus on the Iranians to actually honor what they say they want to do, which is to have a peaceful nuclear program, and potentially even improving their bilateral, if not multilateral, relationships. And that's all good and well. But in the meantime, you have a major issue in the U.S. with strategic communication. This dualistic approach of maintaining stability and security in the Gulf while also making headway or moving forward with Iran, step by step, not in giant leaps and bounds, is being dramatically misinterpreted both by the Iranians and local allies and opponents in the Middle East. It's being taken to all the extremes of conspiracy theories. It's been taken to the point of the U.S. having grand designs, when in fact what you have is a U.S. that's trying to signal to the Middle East, to its partners and to its opponents, that, look, there's an effort here to manage instability, to minimize the impact of these pressures. And you're not going to see a dramatic shift either in relations with Saudi Arabia or with Iran.
Well, Aram Nagezian, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagezian, who's a senior fellow and the Ali Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagezian has authored and co-authored a number of reports for CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risk of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how just 85 people on this planet are as wealthy as half of the world's population. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roderick Tremblay, who's a Professor Emeritus of Economics and International Finance at the University of Montreal. He served as President of the North Economics and Finance Association, President of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement. His books in English include The New American Empire and his latest, The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roderick Tremblay.
I'm very glad to talk to you.
So in terms of humanist principles, in terms of global ethics, Oxfam has just come out with a report which coincides, of course, with the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which it's called Working for the Few. And it finds that this report finds that 85 people on this planet are as wealthy as half of the world's population. That is, I would say, would indicate that we have a global ethical problem, surely.
Yes, you're right. I'm even surprised that half of the world population has enough wealth to match the 85 super billionaires. Because we live in a world of in a period of more and more wealth concentration, and with the principle of compound interest, the more wealth that you have, the more you get. And I think we are going back to the 19th century when robber barons, so-called robber barons, used to run the government and run the economy and run the media. and how these forces reinforce each other to produce wealth concentration on a domestic level, but also on the world level.
Well, specifically, the study finds that the richest 1% had $110 trillion in wealth, which is 65 times the total wealth of the bottom half of the world's population, and that the bottom half of the population of the world owns about $1.7 trillion, or about 0.7% of the world's wealth. So that's the same amount as the wealth owned by the 85 richest people. That's how the report goes. So when you say we're entering a new era of global robber barons, you could also suggest, I think, that we're heading into a period of new feudalism, are we not?
Oh, yes, new feudalism and new economic stagnation, because a lot of that wealth that Oxfam mentioned is hoarded. It's not recycled in the economy. And this creates a permanent economic stagnation. And if you add bad economic and political policies by governments, this, of course, reinforces it. In the past, governments had the goal, the objective of equalizing a bit the results of the market failures. But nowadays, governments stay out of that. And so the process of wealth concentration and income disparities increase over time. Now, if you look only for the 20th century, we are back to before the 1929, as far as the United States is concerned and as far as income inequalities is concerned. So the problems are that we're reaching a peak now. Are things going to get worse? And nobody knows.
Well, the United States, just in the last decade or so, has wasted $7 trillion at least on wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at least $12 trillion on bailing out Wall Street, who almost destroyed the global economy back in 2008. So governments, at least the United States government, is wasting wealth at the same time private individuals are accruing wealth. Is that a way to look at it?
Well, that's one way of looking at it, because this is sort of a perfect storm, you know. You have costly wars abroad, and inside a nation like the United States, you have also a sort of subsidization of banks, of large banks. The Fed has increased, for example, its balance sheet by about $3 billion. Most of that new money was not re-channeled into the economy. It was landed and given to the banks to recapitalizing them to increase their capital.
You meant $3
trillion, not $3 trillion, yeah.
Trillion, not three. You said $3
billion. And you have other policies, for example. We have a policy of exporting jobs through outsourcing. At the same time that the immigration policies bring a lot of new workers inside, therefore we import labor and we export jobs. So there's an incoherence in economic policies and political policies. And if you put that all together, lower taxation for the very wealthy, you put all these factors together, you end up with the result that we see. In my blog, I have a blog called thenewamericanempire.com, and I wrote an article called The Five Pillars of the Growing Inequality on December 18, 2012, a year and a half ago. And I explain why these five pillars are creating that perfect storm that result in wealth and income inequalities.
Again, I'm speaking with Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement. His books in English include The New American Empire and his latest, The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. And we're discussing the Oxfam report that was just released that finds 85 people on this planet are as wealthy as half of the world's population. And I mentioned the 2014 World Economic Forum in Davos underway now, Roderick. Last Thursday, the World Economic Forum stated in a risk assessment that income disparity was one of the 10 global risks of highest concern in 2014. So there you have all the billionaires, world leaders, sitting around in hot tubs in Davos fretting over income disparity. Excuse my cynicism.
Yes, and drinking champagne and probably criticizing any policies that will try to cure that. Out of the 10 global challenges, I think wealth and income inequalities is probably second or third, because that will lead to political instability, permanent political instabilities in many countries, and we see that exploding. We see these revolutions are taking place in many, many countries, because now with the instant information world that we live in, people know that they are poor. In the past, they didn't know, you know, they had no way. Everybody was poor around them. But now they go on the internet, they watch television, and they know that people are very rich somewhere and some, and they are very poor, and they don't want to accept that anymore, and that leads to political instability. So that's a fact, but I would like to know what proposals they have to advance to try to mitigate that problem.
So is this inexorable, though? That's what I find extraordinary, Roderick Tremblay. Here we are in the American democracy that's based upon the myth of the American dream and of upward mobility, the Horatio Alger, you just, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and the sky's the limit. And yet the reality is a downsizing of the middle class and of working Americans, and conversely, the rich getting richer, and even one of the richest people in the United States, Warren Buffett, has warned that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy, and that seems to be where we are heading. What is driving this, do you think?
The main reason is because there are no debates, no basic debates on the problems. Everything is superficial, opinions. The media do not do their job. Academia is remote from reality, and governments are very corrupt, and they cater to the fundraisers and to the people who give them money. And of course, the more wealth and the more money a minority has, the more they can influence the political process. And it's a vicious circle in a way, and that's why it's very difficult. It will be very difficult to cure that and prevent it from getting worse. If I look only at the first of my five pillars, the fact that we have open markets worldwide, and we have give a free movement of capital and companies around the world, while labor is not mobile, of course, for linguistic reasons, for nationalistic reasons, whatever, and therefore there is a dichotomy between the need of the working people and the need of the large corporations. The large corporations can pack money outside of the United States, for example, and do not pay taxes. There are many large American companies. I won't name any, but you can go on Google and you will know who they are. They have billions of dollars which are ordered, and they are not brought back to the United States to create jobs, but they are ordered, and they don't pay taxes on that because the tax code here in the United States says that you can keep your money. A corporation can do that. An individual cannot do that, but a corporation can keep the money outside of the United States and not recycle that money inside the economy in the U.S. So this is an incoherent economic policies proposed by people who profit from it, from these policies, but the largest number of people are hurting by that.
And what explains the global disparity then? You've given us an explanation for what's happening here in the United States. Does the same explanation apply to the rest of the planet?
Well, the rest of the planet, it's not everybody who has It's not all countries that have oil, for example. Of course, in the Middle East, they have bad governments and bad policies, but they have so much oil, they can get away with it. But in Africa, it's different. Their political system is not very solid. They will need a tremendous amount of investments to create jobs, but they still have a tribal approach to problem. Their rate of growth of population is much faster than what their economy can produce. That's why they have to emigrate to Europe and North America. So there are many reasons. Asia is much more on the right path, though. China, especially China and Japan, of course, South Korea. These are countries that are getting out of their poverty fast. That's part of the world. South America is not too bad also. South America, Brazil, Argentina, Chile are getting faster out of the poverty. But there are pockets. Some governments, North Korea, of course, is a good case, where people are poor and are going to remain poor for decades to come if policies are not changed.
Well, just in closing then, Roderick Tremblay, I suppose the difference between, say, Russia and the Ukraine, which is in turmoil because the ruling family are stealing the country blind, and Putin is supposed to, in Russia, supposed to end up as one of the richest men on the planet. So here in the United States, our politicians don't steal us blind. They just enable the rich and powerful to basically steal us blind. Is that the difference?
Yeah, well, political corruption is widespread. We have democracy in name, but in reality, we have plutocracy. Even on my blog, I wrote an article a few years ago about plutocracy replacing more and more democracy. A guy like Franklin Delano Roosevelt could not be elected nowadays because his proposals will be killed by rich contributors. My biggest fear is that political corruption prevents any cure to that disease of increasing wealth and income inequalities. It's a vicious circle. It will be very hard to break that circle.
Well, Roderick Tremblay, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Roderick Tremblay, who's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement. His books in English include The New American Empire and his latest, The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Robert Gates' new memoir, which our guest calls a political psyop disguised as a candid tell-all memoir.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bitty rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here.
And Mike, you have an article at Truthout about Bob Gates, which you titled Gates Agonistes. And essentially what you're saying here, that Robert Gates' new memoir, Duty, a memoir of a Secretary of Defense at War, is a political psyop disguised as a candid tell-all memoir.
Well, that's right. I must confess, all this talk that I heard in the media, our independent and free media, about what a truth-teller Gates is, and sort of the noblest Roman of them all, I confess that fatigues me. If the man is sincere, then so was P.T. Barnum.
Well, it's odd that he had this reputation of being the ultimate sort of nonpartisan go-to guy that gets things done, and that his greatest asset was his discretion. He's certainly not being discreet about what he's saying about private counsel that he's had with presidents, vice presidents, and cabinet secretaries, not to mention the heads of the military.
Yes, normally operatives in Washington say, well, I can't tell you what I said to the president or what he told me because that's confidential and between us. Not in his case, the great man of discretion, who, by the way, helped engineer Iran-Contra by writing phony intelligence assessments that Iran was moderating so that the Reagan administration could sell arms to Iran, and the proceeds in some loopy deal would go to a bunch of mobbed-up crooks called the Contras in Central America and circumvent U.S. law. He did that. He phonied up Soviet intelligence estimates. He deliberately inflated the threat to please Bill Casey, who was his boss, and the Reagan administration. So that put a nice big hole in our budget for several years running. And he escalated two wars, the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, and he lobbied for that escalation. And for this man to say that presidents sometimes are too quick to grasp for a military solution is hypocrisy of the utmost.
So what do you think, though, is behind this tell-all, as you call it, a psyop? What is he trying to do here? Because he's always been a wholly owned subsidiary of the Bush family, as far as I can tell. And is he trying to pave the way for Jeb Bush, who clearly now has a much better shot that Chris Christie's in trouble?
Well, now that Chris Christie, as in the 1977 movie about the Arnhem operation, went a bridge too far, I do think that tends to clear out the field. And I suppose Jeb Bush is counting on everyone's amnesia about the Bush family. Now, Gates was famously a man of discretion when he protected his superiors in the Iran-Contra investigation. Lawrence Walsh, who was the special prosecutor, was quite frustrated, as he wrote in his memoirs, that this very sharp and incisive Gates had a sudden memory loss. So his discretion served then-Vice President George H.W. Bush very well, just as his indiscretion is now serving to retrospectively enhance the reputation of George W. Bush and fool people into thinking that, well, he was a sincere statesman as opposed to this waffling Obama.
And, of course, between the two Bush presidencies, Bob Gates became the dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University.
Well, that's right. And it's just yet another example of many we could point to at the kind of corruption that is overtaking the academic field in America because of this revolving door between government operatives, many quite partisan, and higher education. This will taint, over time, the independence of academia.
I was struck, though, Mike, by the curiously softball questions coming from Jon Stewart of The Daily Show when he interviewed Bob Gates. But when Jon Stewart asked Gates a very, I think, a real important question about the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address, and the fact that we're still spending more, or certainly as much money as we spent against Soviet Russia during the Cold War, and we have nothing but a handful of cave dwellers threatening us in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the question from Jon Stewart to Gates was, does the military-industrial complex itself act as a factor in, you know, driving us towards war? And, of course, he didn't answer that, and he wasn't required to answer that. So what was your reaction to that interview with Jon Stewart?
I think it was appalling. He sort of lobbed him underhand softball questions that allowed Gates to go on and on about his concern for the troops. Again, he made that statement, quite incredible statement, about how presidents are too quick to reach for military solutions, and Stewart didn't call him on it. And of course he said, well, America, after all, is an indispensable nation, which is this kind of neoconservative code language for American exceptionalism, which is a kind of moral relativism in foreign policy. It's bad if anyone else does it. It's okay if we do it.
Well, the only thing worse, though, to give Jon Stewart his due, was Charlie Rose's interview with Gates. I mean, that was pathetic.
Well, there's a long history of this. The so-called late dean of Washington journalists, David Broder, wrote in, I believe, 2009, that Gates was incapable of dissembling. I mean, if there's any phrase that a journalist should never use, it's that.
Well, he wouldn't have got his job at the CIA if he was incapable of dissembling. That's a part of their job.
Apparently so, and dissembling to the special prosecutor when the chips were down, but skillfully enough that he avoided indictment. So George H.W. Bush didn't have to pardon him as he pardoned all the other convicted Iran-Contra conspirators on his way out the Oval Office door.
So I guess Gates is, you know, General Petraeus, who, of course, he defended because Petraeus was the architect of the surge in Afghanistan that he rolled Obama into agreeing to, and it was a complete waste of lives and money, as many had predicted. They call them the coinistas, the counterinsurgency lobbyists, as opposed to the counterterrorism people, led by, I guess, Vice President Biden. But here we are getting out of that god-awful place, and you can tell that it's all been for naught. But Petraeus has gone to work for a big Wall Street leveraged buyout firm. Where do you think Gates will end up? Back in academia, working for the Bush family?
In some capacity or other, that's likely. We'll have to wait for 2016. We know that David Petraeus, whom Gates thought was so unfairly treated by the Obama administration, somehow landed on his feet with a leveraged buyout firm, Kohlberg Kravitz Roberts. And I haven't seen anywhere on his resume that he has that type of experience in his background. But somehow, I guess, being able to peddle influence makes you employable.
Well, certainly it doesn't appear to matter to these Wall Street firms. It's the name they're buying and the access, as opposed to whatever dubious financial skills these candidates may have. But the Bush family itself, of course, is involved, the father, through Frank Carlucci and others that have worked for him, as an important player in the Carlyle Group, who in turn own Booz Allen Hamilton, the people that Edward Snowden worked for. And that,
they're the biggest single contractor for the National Security Agency.
Right, and they're in turn owned by a company that literally started as an inside the Beltway, inside government, you know, I can't think of the word actually. I was going to say parasites, but they essentially trade on insider information about who's going to get defense contracts and then buy up these companies. That's how they've made their fortune, and they're buying companies all over the place. So I guess that's where the rubber meets the road in this discussion, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. Now, it's probably futile to speculate on where Gates is going to go, or is he just going to sit in his study at his home in Washington State in retirement. I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's worth mentioning the contrast between how a person like Petraeus, whom he's defending so strongly, what his fate is versus the fate of many Afghanistan and Iraq veterans who come home to higher unemployment. They have higher than average unemployment for people in their demographic. They have difficulty getting their disability ratings adjudicated by the VA and so forth. So the military-industrial complex doesn't quite seem to work in such a rewarding fashion for the enlisted people on the sharp end of the spear.
Well, I guess it's right-wing welfare, isn't it? That's what's been going on since President Reagan. You know, this whole idea of the contractors is a form of right-wing welfare, surely. You know,
well, it's military Keynesianism, but with a curious twist in that its stimulative effect is such to transfer wealth upwards to the shareholders and the executives in these companies. Many of whom, if not most, are retired generals.
So what's your sense then, Mike Lofgren, of whether or not the Republicans and the Bush family are going to make a comeback? I mean, the idea that in 2016 the American people would have to choose between another Bush and another Clinton is in itself a pretty depressing specter. But what's your sense of the machine? It's getting into gear. I bet you they field a better team than they did under Romney, and they couldn't get you couldn't find a worse candidate, so they're going to have somebody better than Romney. And it seems to me that this unlimited amounts of money are going to be spent, and this midterm coming up, the Democrats, as you've written in your book, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, they don't seem to be have a narrative. They lost their narrative over the shutdown that, you know, in other words, the other guys are really bad, so you have to vote for us because they screwed up the launch of Obamacare. What's your sense of where we're heading politically in this year?
Well, it's hard for me to say what things are going to look like next year or in 2016, but it certainly is not something I would exclude that somebody like Jeb Bush is testing to see, you know, what degree of amnesia the public has. But I can add, you know, sort of parenthetically, that if it's a 2016 situation between yet another Clinton and yet another Bush, I think we have to figure out some way to resurrect H.L. Mencken to describe the whole thing.
Well, but what I'm suggesting, though, Mike, is that this year is the more important year, in effect, because it really will determine whether or not Obama is a complete lame duck. If the Republicans get the Senate and the House, they hold the House and get the Senate, then it's all over for the Obama administration.
And I would agree.
And I don't understand why they're not treating it, and the Democrats themselves aren't treating 2014 as a make-or-break year, because off-term elections, that you don't have the turnout. And the only way they're going to win or hold on is with a big turnout.
Well, I guess the answer is, what have they got to run on? The answer is not much.
Except that the other guys are worse than us, which is their normal platform.
Right. That's the normal thing. And that doesn't drive people to the polls. in significant numbers. And, you know, they lucked out in 2012 with the president at the top of the ticket and turnout higher. But typically, it's only the energized bases that turn out in a midterm. So they are in trouble.
So just in closing then, is there anything to be learned from Bob Gates' psyops in terms of how the Republicans might frame their election, particularly the foreign policy side? Because after all, in 2016, the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is likely to be the Democrat. So, and they've tried their best to make Benghazi hang that around her neck. So it looks like, you know, Gates might be the helping them or be the beginning of rewriting history in order to make her look bad.
Well, in a sense, that's true. And I would have thought the Democrats would have had somebody better to run if foreign policy is going to be the issue, because she, after all, voted for the authorization of the use of force, all her ex post facto rationalizations notwithstanding. She voted for it.
The Iraq War, you mean?
For the Iraq War.
Right.
And in so doing, it muddies any difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on foreign policy in 2016. It will be basically fought out over, is the public more fatigued over having two successive four-year terms for a Democrat and they don't want a third, versus the fact that they'll still be probably sick and tired of war. I think Gates' little propaganda effort here has somewhat limited traction now. It might be useful in the margin.
Well, Mark Lufkin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Enjoyed talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Lufkin, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And he has an article at Truthout, Gates Agonistes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and we were going to have Sean Wilentz on today talking about his article at the New Republic, Leakers. Would you feel differently about Snowden, Greenwald, and Assange if you knew what they really thought? It turns out he's coming out to Los Angeles for the Emmys, where he's up for an Emmy Award, and I'm leaving also today for Washington, D.C., so I'll be broadcasting there tomorrow, Thursday, from Washington, but we'll do it soon. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.